Well, we're only going to be looking at the first four commandments this morning, from verses 1 to 11. And I guess the question that comes to mind whenever we begin to go and look at the Ten Commandments and the law in general is, why are the Ten Commandments still relevant to me, to you? You know, do I need to still obey them? After all, are we not under the new covenant? That is what Jesus said, isn't it? On the night before he died, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. So how, as those under that new covenant — covenant simply is an agreement between God and his people, I am your God, you are my people — we demonstrate loyalty and love and faithfulness to him and he to us. So how do we relate as those under a new covenant because of Jesus to what was given under the old covenant? Because on one level, as we read through the Old Testament laws, we don't obey all of those, do we? I mean, none of us are dressed with tassels on our clothing. Most of us are wearing mixed fabrics. Most of us eat pork. And yet we read the Ten Commandments, these 10 words of God, and instinctively feel we should obey them. But why them and not other parts? And to begin to answer that question, we'll see more of the answer over the coming weeks. But for now, we just need to understand, look, although we're under the new covenant because of Jesus, there is both a continuity with the old — there's similarity — as well as discontinuity. Things have changed. And the obvious continuity begins as you look at the Bible as a whole. After all, it's one story revealing one God, pointing to his one Son and one rescue. Jesus makes clear the whole Bible points to him. So if it's telling one story, then there's going to be continuity between what is written in the old and what we're told in the new. Hence Paul writes, Romans 15 verse 4, that everything that was written in the past was written to teach us, so that through the endurance taught in the scriptures and the encouragement they provide, we might have hope. Or 2 Timothy 3:16, all scripture is God-breathed and is useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, training in righteousness. So yes, the old covenant was written to them, but it still shows in principle how to worship and love God, and therefore how to live as his people, and how not to live as his people. As Paul says in Romans 7, that the law exposes our sinfulness. And in Galatians, he tells us, it therefore shows us our need of a Saviour. So it's still helpful to us, useful to us, good for us. And yes, it was administered at a time to a nation with laws to govern them and an animal sacrificial system to deal with sin. So how we apply that law will be different. It's going to be shaped by love for God and love for others. And we'll see that particularly as we get into the laws in the latter chapters of Exodus, as regarding them more specifically as a nation and the sacrificial system. And we'll see that actually, yep, Paul says Christ is the end of the law, so there's going to be difference, there's going to be discontinuity. But there's something fundamental about these 10 words. They will be kept in a special box called the Ark and described as the covenant. They're the foundation. The rest of the law, in many ways, is an explanation, a working out of these 10. Some have described these 10 commandments as the kind of constitution of a country, and the rest of the laws as the laws of the land that are shaped by that constitution. Hence, they're a more foundational position for us, too. And, of course, nearly all the 10 commandments are directly picked straight up and applied to us as New Testament believers by Jesus. So there is a continuity that makes them relevant to us immediately. But there is also discontinuity. There's a difference. Because Jesus takes these 10 commandments and he begins to apply them in a fuller and a deeper way for those who are now under the law of Christ, love. And as those filled with his Spirit, with the law written on our hearts, not just on stone tablets. And of course, the great difference is that we're not seeking to obey them in order to keep the law. For the Israelites, their obedience was dependent on them, oh yeah, the covenant, this agreement that God gave them was initiated by grace, but it was ultimately a covenant of works. They had to obey, to uphold it, to keep it. Whereas for us, Jesus has obeyed it. He keeps it perfectly for us, fulfilling it all. And we're covered in his obedience, and he's covered in our disobedience. And so we obey not in order to keep the covenant, but out of love, and to live out what it means to be his people. So with all that in mind, let's begin to have a look. Remember, the people are at the mountain. It's a sight to behold. Mountains quaking, there's trembling, there's smoke, it's noisy. Verse 1, we learn God speaks. And he's speaking, remember, to his people. See what he says? I am the Lord your God. Implication, they're his people. For I am the one who brought you out of slavery, out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. So what is about to be said is not how to become his people, but how to live as his people in loyalty and love to him. And of course, the echoes ring true for us. He rescued us from slavery to sin and Satan. He did so through Jesus' death on the cross. As such, he's brought us into relationship with him. He is our God. We are now his people. As those under that law of Christ, love, we love God and love people. And the first four commandments reveal how we love God, how we're to be loyal to him, faithful to him. So firstly then, love God by having no other gods but him. See verse 3? You shall have no other gods before me. The word gods includes all made up false gods that the other nations worshipped. Even carries the connotation of supernatural beings, including angels, non-human and non-earthly beings, spiritual beings. None of them are to be worshipped. I alone am to be worshipped as God, says God. Nothing else. And let's be clear, the command is not that you can worship other gods as long as I'm number one. You know, he's not saying, like I might say to the kids, look, I don't mind if you support Brighton and Hove, Southend United, as long as Arsenal is number one as your football team. Well, clearly you're not allowed to follow Tottenham. But, you know, as long as Arsenal's, you can follow who else you like. No, that's not what he's saying. He's saying he alone is to be worshipped. There is to be no other gods, full stop, none but him. No mediums, no occults, no other spiritual beings, nothing. Him. Because he rescued them and made them his people. Their loyalty, their love is to him and him alone. They're not to even think about worshipping or adding other gods, the Baals or any of the Egyptian gods that they may become familiar with. The sun gods, the river god, the frog god. None. Him alone. And of course, Jesus models that perfectly, doesn't he? So we read in John 17, verse 4, Jesus speaking to his Father. He says, I have brought you glory on earth by finishing the work you gave me to do. In other words, all that Jesus did was to bring glory, honor, worship to his Father. He loved God wholeheartedly. Everything he did brought worship to his Father. What about us? I mean, on one level, this seems obvious and easy to do. Of course, I love God alone. I have no other gods. I'm not going to go and become a Muslim and worship Allah. I'm not going to go and become a Hindu and worship their kind of multiple gods. And nor am I going to think about bolting on another religion. I'm not going to become a Christian and a Muslim or a Hindu and a Muslim, a Hindu and a Christian. No, I'll worship God, no other gods. But of course, Jesus begins to help us see what this really will entail when he begins to demand our exclusive love. In fact, Jesus makes it really clear that we're to love him even before our mothers and fathers and husbands and wives and children. That there is to be nothing more important in our lives than God. Nothing. So we read 1 John 2:16, do not love the world or anything in the world. So don't love money or stuff more than God. Do not love your work more than God. Do not love your family more than God. Do not love yourself more than God. Do not love your sport or your gaming more than God. Because what you love most is what you'll worship most. It's what you'll serve. Is what you'll make a priority of. It's what you'll spend your time and money on. And no one, says Jesus, can serve two masters. You shall have no other gods before me. This first commandment is the kind of the root of all the others, because whatever matters most to us is what will determine our behavior and emotions. It's what will shape us. So have you ever made something more important than God? Have you ever loved something or yourself more than God? And of course the answer is yes, which reveals our great need for Jesus, isn't it? And his death on the cross and him to fulfill this perfectly for me. But as those who are now his people, what will it mean to love God and love Jesus and have no other gods and he alone be worshipped? See, ask yourself the question, what are you putting first before God? Is your heart's desire to love him before all other things, all other gods? That's what it will mean to love him. What about secondly, love God through right worship of him as he has revealed? See verse 4, you should not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven or above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. Now behind this is not so much the idea of them setting up little stone statues and calling them Baal. The worship of other gods has already been forbidden in command 1. Therefore, more of what has been forbidden here is them from carving or making any image and worshipping it as Yahweh, as God. You think about the golden calf that they'll sadly create in a few chapters' time. They make this golden calf and they attribute all that God has done in rescuing them to it. And they have a feast, we're told, to the Lord. They have in many ways carved something to represent in many ways who God is. In other words, what they're trying to do is they're trying to reduce God to something of their own making. It's not necessary to replace him, but to make him manageable. I mean, think about it. I mean, it's much easier to worship a golden calf who you can limit. Who doesn't speak and who doesn't make mountains tremble and quake and whose powers and whose purposes fit your mind and your ideals. Easier than being confronted with a God who cannot be controlled or manipulated or squeezed into a mold or to fit your thinking. See, that's what's been forbidden, carving an image, making anything to reduce God to something made by us so that we can understand him according to our notions rather than according to how he has revealed himself. And Jesus never reduced God. He never reimagined God. He says, John 5, the Son can do nothing by himself. He can only do what he sees his Father doing. Because whatever the Father does, the Son also does. He perfectly represented God. Never sought to squeeze him down, never sought to make him fit his mold. He perfectly represented him. Now here's the thing. It's unlikely we're going to start making little stone statues or carrying a kind of little painted picture of Jesus in our pocket to worship. But have you ever judged God? Have you ever thought, thinking, if I was God, I wouldn't have done it that way. God, why me? God, you've got this wrong. Or, I don't really think of God as wrathful. I like to think of God as loving, just purely loving. He doesn't really get angry. He's a God of love. Hey, he doesn't mind whether men marry men or women marry women, as long as there's love. I mean, after all, he's loving. Because his love, he'll let everyone into heaven. He's a loving God. He lets us do how we want to live. It doesn't really matter as long as we're not hurting others. He's a God of love. And you can see what's beginning to happen in those situations is that we're beginning to create an image of God that is not how God has revealed or expressed himself in his word, but how we want him to be shaped by our culture, by our thinking. And we then worship that version of God. It's not drawing an image as such. It's not carving a statue, but it's creating an image of God according to my thinking and my ways, rather than as he has revealed himself in his word. And this command comes with quite a strong warning. See what he says? For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. He's jealous in the sense he does not want our affections being transferred onto gods that are of our making. He wants our affections to worship him as he is. And his jealousy is then expressed in judgment, a righteous, right judgment. It is a wicked thing to worship something that is not God and attribute it to God. And then you get this phrase. He'll punish the children for the sin of the parents to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me. Now, he's not saying, I'll punish the children and the grandchildren because of what their parents and the grandparents did. That would be unjust. It's contrary to what is revealed elsewhere. So we read Deuteronomy 24, verse 16. Parents are not to be put to death for their children, nor children put to death for their parents. Each will die for their own sin. What is being expressed in Exodus 20 is the seriousness of worshiping that which has been made. And God's determination to punish successive generations for committing the same sins that they learned from their parents. In other words, God will not say, I won't punish this generation for what they are doing to break my covenant, because after all, they just merely learnt it. No, each will be punished. Same's true now. If the kids reject Christ because the parents have rejected Christ, both are held accountable for rejecting Christ. But look what God goes on to say. Kind of declares his true wish in stark contrast to what has just been said. He'll show love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commands. Those who love and worship him as he has revealed, he will love. Jesus says the same. Whoever has my commands and obeys them, he is the one who loves me. He who loves me will be loved by my Father. I too will love them and show myself to him. God loves those who worship and love him as he has revealed himself. We don't have the right to worship or invent our own versions of God. That is not to love him properly. Can you imagine if your husband or wife continually called you by a pet name that you hate it? If you've been in the Song of Songs, my little dove. Or imagine they gave you chocolates that you were allergic to and despised, but you love. That's not love, is it? To love God is to love him as he has revealed himself, to worship him as he declares. Love him. Thirdly, love God by not misusing his name, verse 7. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord who will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Now, the significance of this is seen in the importance of name. Name in the Bible is associated with a person's character, who they are. Literally, the verse says, you shall not carry the Lord your God's name wrongly. Or the ESV translates it, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain or falsely. And the way this command is phrased makes it general enough for any misuse. So from the swearing of an oath in the name of the Lord and breaking it, to making light of his name, either as a swear word or overtly mocking it, to doing something in his name through what is said or done that then damages his reputation, his character. God takes his seriously his name because it represents who he is, his very being, his very character. Which is why Jesus says, John 17, I have revealed your name to those whom you gave me. Jesus' whole being was to reveal his Father's name, to make him known, to make his Father's character and being known to us. And so much so that Jesus commands us, Matthew 5, to not even swear an oath full stop by heaven or by earth, instead just to let our yeses be yes and our noes be no. There's not even to be a hint of misuse of God's name. And then how we speak of God and how we behave reflects on his name, his character. If you're speaking one thing and behaving in a completely different manner, you are misusing his name. You're damaging the very character of God. I mean, look at Jesus. Nothing he did ever brought shame or hatred on the character of God. Do we? Yeah. Hence our need of Jesus. There's also the obvious here, isn't there? It's not just a line of what we do and what we say and seeking to live it out in reflection of his character. We're not to be those who use his name as a swear word. OMG. But I wonder whether this also causes us to think about how we respond to those who do. You know, you're in your workplace. You're at school. You're in your neighborhood. Do you just let it slide? And in letting it slide, do we then just become complicit in the misuse of God's name? Especially seeing how seriously he takes this. Because it's not just his name that's at stake. It's his very being, his very character. If we then choose to say something, is the response, please don't because it offends me, true enough? Or do we need to explain more? It offends me because actually you're maligning my God. You're speaking ill of him. You're rubbishing his very character. See, do we need to spell it out a little bit more? See, to love God is to love who he is. It's to do all we can to protect his reputation, his character. In front of our friends and our family, that's then reflected in our speech, in our behavior, that he might be seen for who he is. See, to love someone well is not to malign them. You do all you can to uphold and protect their character. I imagine most of you, all of you, will quickly defend a family member's character if they're being maligned. Are you as quick to defend God's character and his name? Do you love God in that way? Fourthly, love God. Oh, no. By remembering and resting in him. See, verse 8, remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. Now, there are two aspects of this command. One is that we're to rest. We'd have a day off once a week, and all were to have that day off. Everyone in that Israelite camp was to have a day off, including the foreigners, the slaves, the animals. In other words, you couldn't be an Israelite and have a day off, but get all your foreigner friends and slaves to do your work for you. You know, everyone was to rest. And in resting in this way, they reflected God, who created in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested. Second aspect to this command is to remember. They were to remember their God. That's why it was to be a holy day. The ESV translates verse 8 as remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. With the implication, look, this was already a holy day. The NIV gives the impression by remembering we make it a holy day. No, it's already a holy day. It was a day set apart for God. It was a day he blessed, verse 11. It was as such, it was a day for them to enjoy his blessing. And ours built into their life was this day designed to help them become spiritually stronger and closer to God. A little later in Exodus, we discover that this was a sign of the covenant. This marked them out as different to the other nations as they gathered each week to rest and remember. So how does this relate to us? Now, of course, if you want to have an interesting debate amongst Christians, ask them their views on the Sabbath. So let me go for it. Look, we're not under the old covenant. We're not under its sign, therefore. Actually, the Sabbath is the only command that Jesus does not reiterate. In fact, he only speaks of the Sabbath in conflict with those who represent the old covenant. Paul makes it a matter of indifference. So Romans 14, verse 5, one person considers one day more sacred than another. Another considers every day alike. Each of them should be fully convinced in their own mind. Indeed, in Galatians 4, 8 to 11, Paul says that imposing special days on people is to enslave them all over again. It pushes people back not to Sinai, but to Egypt. Therefore, he says, Colossians 2, 16, do not let anyone judge you with regard to a religious festival, a new moon celebration, or a Sabbath day. So we're not under any obligation or command to have a Sabbath day in the same way. However, Jesus summarizes the whole law as loving God and loving people. Paul tells us, Romans 13, that we fulfill the law by love. In other words, living out its principles in love. So how do we just demonstrate our love for God as expressed by this command? Well, we know this side of the cross that the Sabbath day foreshadowed the true rest, the eternal rest, Hebrews 4. And that rest now comes in Jesus. Jesus alone gives us rest, both now and eternally. So Jesus says, Matthew 11, 28, come to me, all you who are wearied and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest in your souls. Rest for us ultimately is found in Jesus, not in a day off. So much so that actually we can have a day off from work and yet still not be rested in our souls. Because we've not come to Jesus, nor cast our burdens or concerns, our weariness onto him. We've not sought him in the chaos and the busyness of life, so we're not rested, even though we've had a day off from work. I'm sure many of you have experienced that. You've had the weekend, but you still feel not rested. Conversely, sometimes in the chaos of life, we can be so busy and yet be truly rested because we're looking to Jesus. I mean, God did not stop working on the seventh day, but he rested, so there is a rest that's distinct from not working. So we love God by coming to Jesus for rest. But the New Testament also encourages us to remember, to regularly meet with believers to do so. Hebrews 10, verse 25. Do not give up meeting together. Throughout Acts, we see the church making it a priority to gather and to hear the apostles' teaching and pray together and break bread together to remember the salvation the Lord brought us. And as we remember together, we rest together in Jesus. So although we're not commanded in the same way to have a Sabbath day, to love God, we are to rest and remember still. And that's clear from the New Testament. And we do that together. That you can't just do that individually. We need to help one another both remember and rest. Culturally, Sunday is the day still, which is best for that. In other cultures, that might be Friday or Saturday. I know the Chinese church in Brighton meets Tuesday because that is the best day for them. For us, it's Sunday. It's the best day for us to gather together, to rest and remember. So making gathering with God's people on a Sunday a priority in your life is a good thing. And where we can, depending on the nature of our work, to stop and gather and make it a feature of our week as a way of expressing love for God and love for his people. not in obligation to a command, but out of love, in order to fulfill what it means to rest and remember him corporately. But it might also mean you do things differently as a family and as an individual to rest and remember, so that that day is not just like any other day, but it's a day to enjoy God's blessing, a day to share with God's people in food, a day to enjoy his creation, a day to enjoy other good things he has given us, a day to be spiritually strengthened, a day to be spurred on and to be encouraged. And the New Testament teaches us we need this. We cannot survive as God's people without rest in Jesus day by day or remembering your salvation. So often the reason we struggle spiritually is because we've stopped resting in Jesus and we've forgotten our salvation. And I find that hard to do as an individual. And so God has given me a church family to help me rest and remember. So why would you not want to make it a priority in your life? And if you don't make it a priority, it won't happen, because there's way too many other choices and options. So how will you then rest and remember with God's people? And of course, on top of all of that, God has made us to be those who need a day off a week from work. That's just a creation principle. And we'd be unwise to go against our Creator and think we know better and work continually. So how are you loving God? Is he alone number one in your heart? Are you worshipping as he has revealed himself, not as you imagined him to be? Are you not misusing his name or maligning his character by what you do and say? And are you resting and remembering in him? Are you loving God?